This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Keats, assistant editor. Hello, Andy.
How's it going, Scott?
Pretty well, pretty good. Joined also Sarah Libby, the managing editor. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
She has acknowledged that her name is spelled incorrectly. Sorry about that.
It is. Like, let's just call it what it is.
All right. Many of you are housing nerds, land use enthusiasts. Voice of San Diego's coverage of that has been important, along with homelessness. And this week, the podcast will be mostly about those things. It was made official this week that the effort to recall San Diego City Council President Jen Campbell has failed. We'll discuss why and the politics of land use that were behind it, and a Senate bill. SB9 is a big deal right now. Politicians from San Diego are pushing it, including Mayor Todd Gloria. Why that is. At the same time, homeless tent encampments are proliferating. Why Gloria says those may get worse before they get better. That's all coming up. Stay with us. But first, we have a couple of updates. We got a letter in the virtual mail right before starting recording. We got an update on one of them. Of course, let me just summarize quickly. A few weeks ago, San Diego City Council member Monica Montgomery Stepp sent out an open letter questioning leadership of the San Diego Unified School District on the trajectory of leadership at Lincoln High School, a very important school in southeastern San Diego's community. Monica Montgomery Stepp was worried about leadership changes there and other rumors and discussions about problems there. And she wanted some answers about the performance of students and other issues there. She sent out this open letter. Now, the district, you remember, school district board member, trustee, and the president of the board, Richard Barrera, said basically, we talked about it last week, maybe stay in your lane, maybe don't bring these things up. And if you want to help, why don't you just do that instead? But they did respond now officially to her with an open letter of their own. And that's one approach that they have taken. Sarah, can you just read how it starts for us here?
Yeah, so it starts with a bang. And it says, a month ago, students from Lincoln High School were insulted, taunted, and compared to convicts. That happened at an elite prep school in a wealthy suburb. So if you're not familiar with this dust up, some kids from Cathedral Catholic posted some sort of memes on social media, I think borrowing from the Notre Dame Miami feud of the 90s, Catholics versus convicts. And they were rightly, instantly criticized and disciplined and very dumb and racist thing to do. So that is what they're invoking here. She goes on to say, treating our students with the type of disrespect was unacceptable then, and it is unacceptable now, even though now the insults and abuse are coming from someone who is paid to represent our community. Your attack on our students and Lincoln High School is beneath the dignity of your office, and you owe those students and our community an apology.
So the letter comes from Sharon Whitehurst Payne, who represents that same neighborhood on the San Diego Unified School Board. Now, again, I think it takes a big step to say that what Monica Montgomery Stepp's own open letter did was attack the students. But then it takes a real step after that to compare it to like a racist insult. I mean, there's a lot going on here. They could have just responded with an answer to her questions and maybe like some pointed language about why, you know, she was off base or whatever. But man, this is quite a step.
I'm astounded by it, honestly. I am frankly astounded. The communications shop at San Diego Unified is run by a guy named Andrew Sharp, who is rightfully regarded as a pugilistic individual who has, you know, he comes from a campaign world. He does, you know, he's ready to fight on any topic. I guess I should be prepared for a district response that would be that ready to escalate the situation. But I never would have expected that it would come, that it would be this aggressive, that it would come from Sharon Whitehurst Payne specifically, that they would make it so personal to Monica Montgomery Stepp, a person who is incredibly well respected in that community.
And indeed, she said initially, you know, I am a city council member. I don't have direct, ownership over San Diego Unified, but this is the top concern that I hear over and over again from members of my community, which is why I feel obligated to raise it. And if you take a step back beyond that, so many of these issues that she was raising and that members of the community have been raising, particularly related to the leadership changes at Lincoln, which have been constant and numerous and disruptive, is that the community doesn't feel listened to. They don't feel listened to. And then to have that raised as if you suggest that they should be listened to, if you suggest that they should have a say in this, you are the racist who is attacking students.
It's like a particularly offensive use of students to hold up and as like a shield.
Yeah, it's,
you know, a human shield for the attack.
They're using the students themselves as insulation for the district.
Yeah, and to say like you can't criticize or even ask questions in an open forum about our approach without actually that being interpreted as an attack on the students, and even from a black woman as a racist attack.
That's
like, this is like, what better way to synthesize their entire approach than that you cannot question us in any form without it being considered inappropriate, if not actual violence. This is just this. I'm almost glad they did this to finally like make clear that they will accept no scrutiny as a democratic institution. None. None is valid.
None.
Remember, and it also highlights how off we were when this first happened,
yeah.
Andy.
Yeah.
Because we said, no way they treat Monica Montgomery Stepp this way.
Right.
Well, because certainly they can't shoot the messenger on this one.
Yes. She will have more credibility on this than Scott Lewis or whatever. And that didn't happen at all.
Yeah, no, I mean,
it's worse.
Are they going to come for Shirley Weber next?
It is not even a little bit of an exaggeration to say that they accused Monica Montgomery Stepp of a racist attack against the students of Lincoln High. That is what this letter says. That is what they claim.
No, it's not even a leap.
It's a plain reading of this letter. That's what they're saying. It's amazing. But to your point about like, I don't know that I'll go as far as to say I'm glad this happened because it's very ugly, but
it's a declaration of war.
Nuclear option. It is the nuclear option. There's no putting this back in the box. The ongoing resentment between San Diego Unified and the idea that anyone outside of San Diego Unified gets to criticize them for anything ever is now blossomed into a full-blown war. And I didn't see it coming. Did not see it coming. I didn't see it coming, and I was quite surprised to read the letter that Monica Montgomery Stepp put forward that kicked all this off. But I didn't think it was going to lead to this much of a reckoning about something that has previously been forced behind the scenes.
Now, they did address some of her questions, but they also said that some of them were completely off limits. They said, you know, one of the main points she asked about was why an administrator of the school, who a lot of people felt was kind of running, at least partly, some of the school, and why that person was removed so fast. They said, you should know better than to request private personnel information related to the employees of the district. I find it unprofessional to demand information on the transfer of an employee. The rationale for our decision was already shared, as you would have known had you contacted the school district before launching an uninformed assault in the media. I mean, this is something. I'm really shocked. You can find this story. Obviously, we'll post the link in the morning report Friday. We'll obviously talk about it more. An incredible escalation of the war of words in southeastern San Diego about the status and leadership of Lincoln High. We'll obviously be following it closely. Speaking of letters, we have another doozy to discuss. The president and provost of Cal State San Marcos University sent a letter to their campus community last week in response to our story. Okay, we explained it last week, but the short version is the university moved to fire one of its professors, Chetan Kumar, for harassing multiple students, for relentlessly sort of pursuing them. University officials, though, reversed their decision after Kumar's union filed an appeal. Now, since then, faculty and others at the school are not happy. They set up a petition. Hundreds of people signed it, demanding that they do indeed carry through and fire him. They've announced that they're going to reassign him. A lot of fallout from that. There was a lot of tension, obviously, on campus about it. So the provost of the university and the president sent out this letter. And it's really interesting. On the one hand, I can't tell, Sarah, if they are defending their decision to fire or to not fire this person, or if they are saying they should have. So, for instance, it says within that we share the fury, sadness, and sense of hopelessness expressed by so many. Frustration does not begin to describe the situation, but we're heartened by the passionate and overwhelming response by our community to support our students and condemn the actions of this individual. So there's that.
Yeah, I think they're definitely trying to have it both ways, because they do point out that they did initially move to fire him, which is true. They did. They determined that his actions violated school policy, state policy, and they tried to fire him. But they're also defending their decision to immediately walk that back and saying they're kind of victims of circumstances beyond control, and also they're devastated by the decision that they made.
Yeah, but then, when they're talking about, why it was justified, obviously they're like, well, we have to do this or that. We had to make the decision that we best could make. We didn't think, they made a point that this would have to go to arbitration, and we had a very deep concern that the arbitrator would overturn the termination at appeal, and if that happened, we wouldn't be able to follow through and let this person go. Now, and you've made the point, I think, that's why arbitration is somewhat questionable in these situations, because we have no way of evaluating that point because it's a secret sort of judicial proceeding. But then they make this point I want to focus on. They said, further, we want to be clear that neither time nor money is ever a factor in decisions related to sexual assault and or harassment. The Voice of San Diego article implied that standard language in all CSU settlement agreements meant that our university put resources ahead of student safety, This is simply untrue. Now, first of all, we did not imply anything at all.
Well, what we did was quoted language that didn't so much as imply that as explicitly say it.
Yeah.
It said it verbatim, and we did put quotation marks around the section that said it verbatim. And to the extent that that's an implication based on its explicitly having been said in the document, then I guess there was an implication made by the person who wrote that settlement.
Yeah. Yeah, they said, okay, just to be clear, we want to be clear that neither time nor money is ever a factor in these decisions. Now, let's read from the settlement agreement. It says, quote, CSU and Kumar enter this agreement to buy peace to avoid the costs of further proceedings. Next line, to avoid the expense, inconvenience, and uncertainty of continued proceedings and resolve all disputes and claims between them. Okay, expense, inconvenience, and uncertainty of continued proceedings. Now, again, we didn't imply anything. If that has an implication that you're worried about, that's your problem. You shouldn't put words that you don't agree with in an official settlement. I don't care how standard they are.
It's very funny that it's like, it's not even a simple sentence. There's a list in the sentence of adjectives.
It says they want to like buy peace to avoid the costs of further proceedings.
It's like a really poetic phrase, to be honest. Yeah, buying peace.
It's like they actually brainstormed. They were like, we need like four or five specific reasons that will explain why we're doing this. And they had a whiteboard and they like eliminated and they chose these three specifically. It actually doesn't read like legal boilerplate, to be perfectly honest with you.
No, that part doesn't at all. No, I often get people who complained about Voice of San Diego implying X or Y, right? Like, and I often have sympathy. Like, okay, I can see how you might see that that was what we were implying or that you inferred that logically. And, you know, we have conversation. This is not those case. This is not the case. This was us quoting from your settlement agreement that we got from a public records request that was legitimate. If you don't believe those words, not our fault, not our problem.
Right.
So there is more fallout, I'm sure, to come from this story. We heard that they reassigned this professor to, what was it, Sarah, to not be involved in actual classes this upcoming semester, but we don't know exactly in what form.
Yeah, so this is a new development that actually happened after they sent the letter. They told Kayla Jimenez, who broke the story, that they have agreed to move him to some sort of new position that won't involve directly working with students. This comes after a lot of his colleagues actually signed a petition urging the school to, I guess, refire him or double down on its decision to fire him, which is something that we haven't seen in a lot of these cases, is the faculty kind of rising up in the way that it has. I think probably them being university professors as opposed to K-12 instructors is, you know, maybe a part of that. But I just want to kind of flag two other parts of this letter or parts of the discussion that I thought were a little interesting. So I don't know if we got into this last week, but part of the agreement that they reached with the professor to come back and not be fired and to continue teaching was simply that he wouldn't have contact with the students who had complained and who had launched, you know, the inquiry. And that they thought that that was like a sufficient punishment is really weird and troubling to me, given that there were enough students. I think there were four who filed official complaints, and their complaints were so uniform and consistent in what they were saying happened that it certainly shows, I think, a pattern of behavior, that this is something that he just does. He asks his students out on dates. He makes inappropriate advances. He makes inappropriate comments. And so this idea that, well, you know, don't worry about it because he's not going to contact these students anymore. Like, the fact that he contacted four of them kind of suggests he's going to contact other people who maybe he hasn't had contact with yet. And so I think that's something that they maybe could do some more explaining of. And then finally, I just want to say, at the end of the letter, they close it out with this promise to continue the conversation. It says, in moments like these, it's important that we reflect on our processes with a commitment to continual improvement, creating the best, safest environment. Just to be clear, they weren't hosting any conversations or ongoing discussion about this until we revealed that it was happening. You know, this decision they made to keep him on didn't happen last week. It was only last week that we reported it. And so now they're hosting a lot of forums and committed to continuing this conversation. They weren't committed to that conversation in any way until it was put out in the open.
Yeah, they were forced to have that conversation.
Right.
Yep.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com.
Campaign to recall San Diego City Council President Jen Campbell has officially failed. This week was the deadline, and the campaign announced that it had not collected enough signatures to put her recall on the ballot. They blamed the pandemic, competition from other signature gathering efforts, and this was my personal favorite, Jennifer Campbell's low name recognition, which proved to be an insurmountable challenge. So she, as you put it, I think, Sarah, she was not popular enough to be recalled.
I think that was Andy, but yeah, that was pretty chef's kiss.
Well, it's like, it's also like the idea of a recall is that lots of people are outraged by the decisions that this person has made, which is quite undermined by the idea that no one knows who she is.
Yeah. Right.
Sure.
Well, that was the case. That was the main talking point that former San Diego City Council member and former mayoral candidate Barbara Bree had made when she had made the announcement back in December that she would help lead the campaign to recall Dr. Jen Campbell, the council president. Let's say that. When she had made the decision to help lead the recall of Jen Campbell, the council president. Remember, she had become council president, a very contentious campaign to become council president over Monica Montgomery Stepp, whom we discussed earlier. So she had gone on KUSI and said, I know for a fact that Jen Campbell is not popular in her district, is unpopular in her district, and we are going to be able to pull this off. So I think, Andy, there was a couple of things already going on. The campaign to recall her had gotten its legs from the issue of vacation rentals. She had forged a compromise between the vacation rental platforms, the hotel workers union, and a few others to come to a deal on how we would regulate vacation rentals, basically just put a cap on them throughout the community and offer permits for those. And then And then there was the issue of the Midway area where she had supported Measure E, was it, that would increase the height limit in the Midway area and the sports arena area. And those two had sort of combined to say, like, we need to get rid of her. The people who are very frustrated and concerned about protecting Point Loma, Mission Beach, Pacific Beach, all these places in their current, quote, community character. That they had rallied to do a recall. And then when she fought with Monica Montgomery Stepp for the council presidency, they got a lot more support from people who were upset that Jen Campbell hadn't allowed Monica Montgomery Stepp to take over that spot. So what do we think happened here? Do you think it's a test of how powerful these sort of arguments about protecting the community character and the concern about community character and how much politics and political power they have?
I do. So part of the reason I would say so, and we've made this point certainly in the politics report, which you should subscribe to and become a member of Voice of San Diego so you can receive, but I think we've made it on this show as well, is that while it's certainly true that a lot of people who support Monica Montgomery's step and thought that she should have been council president were angry about the outcome of that city council vote and opposed the idea of Jen Campbell becoming city council president, it is also true that this recall was organized by and steered by and primarily motivated by concerns by coastal homeowners who do not like the effort to raise the height limit and to increase the amount of vacation rentals.
Let's be clear, to acknowledge them as a legal use of, yes, of any homes in the area.
It is simply a descriptive fact that that was what drove the recall effort, not the decision to make Jen Campbell council president. And so that was a fortuitous outcome that the recall proponents used to help elevate their effort that was already underway.
And it did genuinely attract
and
some
it genuinely
yeah, there,
attracted
there were a
some
handful
support.
Of people who jumped on as a result of the council president debacle.
Right. But that was an effort that existed before that vote and was going to attempt to go forward without that vote, and that was primarily put together by people who were not reacting to that vote. So we should say that clearly. And because
yeah,
that's
and
the
Monica
case,
Montgomery Stepp herself was kind of like, I don't really want anything to do
yeah,
with
that's
this.
Up to her and her constituents.
Yeah, she didn't get involved in it, right?
Exactly.
So, in some ways, it's a bit of a red herring, the council president vote, to a certain extent, about why this was going on. And because that's the case, I would say, yes, that this – it does tell us something. I think it tells us something about the salience or the poignancy of these coastal NIMBY concerns in San Diego politics. Now, it sort of feels like beating a dead horse at this point because – that's the same thing we said about the outcome of Measure E in November. That was to the extent that this was sort of played through in the mayor's race. We said the same thing about the outcome of the mayor's race. To the extent that the city attorney's race sort of dabbled in these issues, we said that about the outcome of the city attorney's race. So, but I think it's another data point demonstrating that things that we used to refer to as like third rail issues in San Diego politics, like coastal height limits, like vacation rentals, like increased development and density, are not as powerful a political motivator or is not as dangerous an issue to grab onto as if you are a political figure as they were once thought. That sort of like Peter Navarro evolving into Donna Fry, that era of San Diego politics has lost its relevance in our current conversation, I think.
Or the people currently trying to, you know, mobilize it have not figured out how to shift the trajectory of local politics with it.
Yeah. Or it's, you know, it could still be an issue of some kind, but it's not enough on its own. Here's the thing that makes it this different is like, it is true that short-term vacation rental change would not have happened without Jen Campbell, without the council member from that district deciding to put her name on this brokered compromise. That wouldn't have broken through in the way that all the previous short-term vacation rental attempts didn't break through. And Measure E, the effort to raise the height limit, that too, like the way that the city council tends to defer to representatives of their district on land use decisions in their district, that wouldn't have happened if she hadn't joined arms with Chris Kate to put that forward also. So the people who were mad about those two decisions, they identified the correct target. But like it is, you know, Jen Campbell is the person that they should be most mad about those things. But it is revealing that even those things, and even limited to District 2 only, not a citywide race, not trying to turn them into citywide issues, just running on those things only in a district-wide decision wasn't enough to even qualify for the ballot.
So they said in their announcement that they'd come short with the signatures, that now their focus is on the 2022 election. But here's the thing with that. So this is the first week of June. This is the moment when these campaigns actually get mobilized for these city council races. We are now exactly a year out from the primaries for these city council seats. There are four city council seats up: Monica Montgomery Stepp, Vivian Moreno in District 8, District 6, San Diego City's council's only Republican, Chris Kate, is now termed out, so that seat is open. And then there's Jennifer Campbell in District 2 on the coast. Now, will she get an opponent? You would think, if you want to be competitive in these city council races, especially against an incumbent, especially against the city council president who can raise lots of money, you would want to have that campaign launched right now. And so we have not seen a high-profile candidate step up for that. And so, you know, regardless of their intense interest in putting up a candidate for that seat, you would think it'd have to happen pretty quickly for it to get enough of a momentum to go and get the resources needed to oust an incumbent.
Yeah, there is the complexity around redistricting, and that Jen Campbell actually does live in an area that could maybe be changed. You know, she might not actually represent the coast anymore, depending on how redistricting goes. I think the thing I would think about is, like, they just took a shot at her and they came up short. So she comes out of that looking stronger. My guess is that going forward, she will be less likely to face a formidable challenger now because of this failed recall effort than she would have been if there was no recall effort at all. This makes her look like, you know, a boxer that just wiped the floor with a substandard contender, right? Competitor. The other thing I would say about the group of people that tried to make this recall happen, the anti-height limit increase, anti-development, anti-short-term vacation rentals folks, is that they had perceived political capital. They had perceived strength. And it's like when you step on the on a basketball court for a pickup game and people don't know if you're good or not yet, and they let you shoot. If you're going to take the shot, you better be able to shoot, because if you reveal that you actually can't shoot, now everyone knows that they don't have to defend you. And right now, I think it's possible that these people just took it upon themselves to demonstrate that they don't actually have they're not actually capable of mustering the political threat that had been presumed they possessed. And so if you're the mayor of San Diego who's looking at the next attempt to increase height limits or development capacity around a transit station in, say, Balboa Avenue, I think you might reasonably ask how much attention you actually have to pay to this type of opposition as people start organizing against the Spaywar redevelopment plan for San Diego Grand Central, and that kicks up a lot of anti-development sentiment. You might look back at this and say, is that actually something we have to care about very much? They might have revealed that the emperor is not wearing any clothes.
Well, the Downtown San Diego Partnership last week released its new updated count of homelessness and tents within the neighborhoods that make up downtown, and it is alarming. The numbers are as high, if not higher, than they were during the hepatitis A outbreak in 2017. And this would be no surprise to anybody who's driven around downtown or gone to a Padres game or whatever. The tent encampments are proliferating. Also in National City, I talked to the mayor of National City, Alejandra Sotelo Solis, who's been trying to deal with an encampment by 16th Street and the 805 and clean it up there. There are a lot of tent encampments across the region expanding, and a lot of politicians worried about them. It was a fascinating response from San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria. I asked him to sort of weigh in on this situation, and his office released a written statement. He said that, you know, it's a very complex problem. They're trying to increase and expand the city's leadership and sort of employees and managers dealing with the issue, and they're partnering with the county, all these things. And he said, quote, a more compassionate approach, that's a more compassionate approach to homelessness, means that homelessness may be more visible as we do the hard work necessary to expand supportive services, increase capacity in our shelter system, and create more affordable housing. So I thought that was a really interesting point. He's like, he kind of acknowledged there that he's backing away from the policy of abating these, of cleaning and sweeping out these tent encampments, that he doesn't believe that's the best practices, and that we all have to just deal with it as that expands. So I'm not quite sure what he's doing. Instead, there's a lot of things mentioned there about how complex of an issue it is and the more compassionate approach. But this is a really interesting turn of events in this whole issue. And, you know, it all boils down to how many permanent affordable homes they're able to get on the market and how soon.
Yeah, I just thought it was like a pretty interesting real talk and kind of like a maybe not subtle jab at former Mayor Kevin Faulkner's approach, which was very police and cleanup centric. And, you know, Todd Gloria has criticized a lot of what Faulkner did to address homelessness. For example, the skydiving building turned homelessness resource navigation center that doesn't include any housing. And so he seems to be saying, you know, we are pursuing these long-term solutions, but my understanding is they're very, very long-term, and building any kind of housing, especially to any meaningful scale, is, boy, that is a long effort.
Yeah, at the heart of this question is the question of housing supply, of building housing. He also announced this week that he supports Senate Bill 9, which is moving its way through Sacramento and the legislature. Now, Andy, what is SB 9 and what's its relationship to housing policy and housing supply?
In the absence of the much more ambitious housing bills that have died in Sacramento in recent legislative sessions, this is now the most high profile, I would say this is the most high profile housing bill going through the state right now. And it would basically allow multiple units on homes that are currently zoned for single family. So you could look at it as like the allowing row house bill or something along those lines, duplexes, those sorts of things. And so, yeah, it's a statewide bill that combats local exclusionary housing requirements that is predictably coming under criticism from small municipalities that have a long history of preferring exclusionary zoning.
Okay. So what we have here is the mayor of San Diego saying, state, we need you to override local policies like the ones that I'm in charge of executing here in San Diego. And we need that because we need to increase the supply of housing. And to him, this all wraps in together. Now, you made a point earlier that, like, he's actually in charge of some policies here that could follow those same guidelines that he's not interested in actually implementing.
Yeah, it's just a strange bank shot of public policy as the mayor who is in charge of the city's planning department that could rewrite our own local zoning ordinance to achieve this result, to instead appeal to Sacramento to make the change and invoke your authority as the mayor as the reason that they should listen to you, when you could instead just act on that authority that you have to do it in your city of 1.5 million people.
It's either a bank shot or it's like kind of like a cry for help, right? Like,
yeah.
I can't do this here. You have to do it for me. Please, please, please. I am victim to these political forces, which we just described a few minutes ago, may not be as powerful politically as has been assumed.
Right. And charitably, I think there's another avenue, which is he maybe sees himself as a regional leader, which the mayor of San Diego certainly is, and that doing this at the state level would have a bigger impact than just doing it at the local level. City of San Diego doing it on its own wouldn't change anything in National City or Chula Vista or La Mesa or Lemon Grove or Santee or Solana Beach, all areas that, based on their proximity to the city of San Diego, are intimately related to our housing market, right? Like,
right.
If you, in search of affordable housing, somebody isn't going to abide by the arbitrary municipal boundaries. You might, like, you know, you could seek affordable housing in La Mesa even if you live in San Diego, right? We have one housing market. So, sure, maybe his authority goes farther by helping it pass at the state level, but you could still do it at the local level too, just in case it does, you know, the legislature doesn't act, right? It's just a strange thing. It's like you were in the legislature last year. You're the mayor now. And if you want your planning department to pursue these sorts of things, direct them to do it and let's see it, you know?
Well, he did vote on a measure to do this last year.
Right, right. Like his call to do it is something he's already done.
Right.
You know, like we already know how he feels about this. Now, you're not one member of the legislature. You're in charge of the city. You don't actually need to appeal to anyone to do it. You can do it now. You're the only person who can just do it in our city.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in San Diego, in the Voice of San Diego headquarters, and throughout the county, wherever we happen to be, because we have that capability as demanded by this work from home reality that we're now emerging from. It's the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in that setting. Keep up with our stories and takes on local news with the Morning Report, our most popular newsletter. Subscribe now at vosd.org/newsletters. That's vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, editor-in-chief of Voice San Diego. Andrew Keats is assistant editor. Sarah Libby's managing editor. This show is produced by Nate John, who did so expertly. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.